Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's pervasive tech-driven culture and the race for shaping the future has brought about fundamental changes to our culture, economy, and social order. Today, we are inundated by technologies and billionaires who promise to improve our education system, even take us to Mars, and eradicate hunger and disease, all with the touch of a button or a new app. But what is being behind the race to the future, and how is this obsession shaping all of us, our economy, and our politics? In his new book, Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future, today's guest, cultural critic Hal Nowiecki, argues that the rise of the future as our organizing principle is having deep and lasting impacts on our families, our communities, and our physical and mental well-being. And he asks crucial questions like, where are we actually heading? How will we get there? And who are we leaving behind? Hal Nowiecki is a cultural critic who writes about the effects of mass media, pop culture, and consumer technology on life and society. He's the author of a number of books, including his latest, Trees on Mars. Hal will be speaking tonight at City Lights Bookstore, 261 Columbus Avenue in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And Hal joins me in studio. Hi, Hal. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I really enjoyed your book. Very fascinating. I mean, you write about everything from what's happening to the humanities and education, to children who are given iPads at such a young age, to tech CEOs. And your book really explores this notion that certain companies and billionaires are trying to shape how we should organize our society with very little connection to our past. What really sparked this idea for this book?
Well, you know, going back, I wrote a previous book called The Peep Diaries, How We're Learning to Love Watching Ourselves and Our Neighbors. And in that book, it was basically all about this this transformation of using our private lives as public entertainment, which maybe now seems kind of old news. And when I finished that book, I thought, you know, there's a wider, there's a sort of broader theme that I keep seeing here, which is people who use technologies almost at random, almost without any ability to resist. And they're just sort of, oh, Facebook, I must be on this. Oh, webcams, I will webcam my life every day. And I thought, there's something here. There's something to be investigated about the relationship we have to technology and ultimately to how we perceive the future.
You write that this has become common now. CNN runs segments on people camping overnight to be the first to buy the latest iPhone. Wired magazine has cover stories celebrating 24-year-old multimillionaire app developers. You say that despite the mainstream prominence of this techno-disruptive futurism, there's really no coverage that puts all of this in context. Mm. No one is really talking about how utterly different this approach to life is.
Yeah, when you start to look at it and you think, okay, every day I hear somebody say, we have to win the future. You know, every politician running for office agrees on that, no matter what political agenda they may have. And then you say, well, what is winning the future? What could that possibly mean? To own the future, to get to the future first? None of it actually means anything. And so when I started kind of really thinking about this issue, the first thing that struck me is that we have actually shifted in our society to arrange a lot of elements of our society to do this thing, owning the future or winning the future. But it doesn't mean anything. And it is, in fact, a very controversial idea that we have embraced without actually thinking about.
But it's happening quickly. I mean, things are changing drastically when you look at from politics down to what's happening in first grade, where kids are given iPads.
Absolutely. And that's the context of this. Is this isn't an abstract idea. This isn't, oh, we're thinking differently. It's we're thinking differently because we're acting differently. And the urge to get to the future, you know, we talk about sort of lineups for the new iPhone or enthusiasm for all kinds of new tech. This is something that is very profound on an actual level. So people feel this urge, and they say, well, I have to get to the future. I can't be left out. I'm going to do something. If there's a new technology, I'm going to embrace it. If there's a new app I hear about, I'm going to put it on my phone, and I'm going to start using it, even though it might not actually be useful for my life. And in fact, it may be a negative. It may be a net negative for my life. But people are so afraid of being left out of this this ownership of the future. It's like a gold rush. You know, no one wants to be the person who didn't bother to trek over to the river and get some gold.
And then talk about the philosophy of a lot of the people who are really jumping on this bandwagon and changing things. You write about this guy, Mark Winter, ex-prize senior director of this tricorder challenge. And he's working on this medical device. And this was a quote from this man, Mark Winter. And this really says a lot about what you're writing about and the argument you're making. He writes, "I think that's true. The trend that we're seeing all around is that people are relying less on government and institutions to do things for them. We're seeing an emergence of more of this with the DIY movement, the do-it-yourself movement, and the maker movement. More and more people taking their future into their own hands and being innovative."
Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of bright, sunny, optimistic, futurist ideology that we can actually upgrade our technologies to the point where we no longer need institutions at all, that the institution will get in the way. So in the case of the tricorder challenge, and we're thinking Star Trek here, right? We're thinking about a machine that can be run up and down your chest and tell you, you know, what's wrong with you in an instant and maybe even cure you. So that's just one example where if we all had tricorders, we wouldn't need doctors. We wouldn't need a medical bureaucracy. You know, we could throw out the whole Affordable Health Care Act and all of those things. And we would just basically be able to do it ourselves. And so this is the empowering philosophy that fuels a lot of these ideas. And again, it sounds very practical and very truthful, but it has, you know, there's huge holes in this argument that keep showing up, and they're sort of like, well, that's just because we just haven't invented the technology to patch up that hole yet.
You have gone to a lot of tech conferences and you've actually asked executives, well, what about the people that we're leaving behind, right? What about the people that don't have access to this technology, either because they don't want it or because they can't afford it? What other insights can you give us just into the minds of the people who are making these new technologies?
The biggest insight is, and you'll hear this very often, disruption is inevitable. The future is inevitable. As Jeff Bezos said, you know, Amazon didn't happen to the bookstore. The future happened to the bookstore. So this is the inevitable consequence of our progression toward a technological utopia. And the people who are left behind they're either the unfortunate sort of accidents who just weren't in the right place at the right time, or they were the curmudgeons who couldn't get on board the bus. You know, there's very little enthusiasm for the idea that technology can't bring all these people along and won't and doesn't want to. You know, that's all just sort of, well, you know, we will get to them. But first we have to, you know, invent a thing that makes me live forever. Then I'll deal with all these other people and their problems.
You were at a conference. It was high-level tech executives. Microsoft was there. A number of other companies were there. And you did say, what about these people who are left behind? Mm. And Troy Carter, there was no, I'm not sure who he is, Troy Carter?
Troy Carter, he's a record producer. He works with Lady Gaga.
Okay.
And so he's known as being a really innovative, high-tech type in the music industry.
So he says, not to sound insensitive, but change is a way of life.
Yeah, and that's what they say. You know, they say, change is a way of life. Don't fight it. Embrace it. And in fact, this is a message that I sort of explore in the Trees on Mars book a lot, where I say, well, in fact, you know what? Change isn't a way of life. That's actually not true. And I don't know if you want to get into this a bit, Rose, but, you know, I argue essentially that in the 4.5 million or so years that humanoids have wandered the planet, most of what we have attempted to do is not change. And when we adopted technologies, we adopted them in the hopes that they would allow us to change only the smallest amount. So, for instance, I talk about the Chumash, a native peoples who have lived off the southern Channel Islands in California for something like 15,000 years, and they can be sort of tracked back. And in that time where they lived on these islands, They never changed. They didn't want to change. They didn't need to change. They only had sort of one big change in their culture where they adopted a more of a trading and sort of a shell bead and jewelry thing because they were running out of food, probably due to overfishing and some climate change. So the idea that all cultures all the time, that all human beings have always been frantically trying to adopt new technologies and change and disrupt their society, it's not true. We are not creatures of progress. We are not creatures of this incessant desire for change. You know, this is really a radical imposition of a commercial ideology on us, the idea that, you know, we have to constantly upgrade and change and buy new things, buying new things being the key to that statement.
Well, and so when you look at the title of your book, Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future, you do have a lot of people who are trying to embrace this change. I mean, people who want to go to Mars, for example. And you write that Elon Musk, the billionaire who owns Tesla, once described Mars as a fixer-upper planet and at one point put a 10-year timeline on colonizing and transforming the planet with as many as 80,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, good luck, Elon. Get out there. You know, he's not going to Mars. That's the funny thing about it. You know, there's actually several tech billionaire types who are now pursuing Mars-like projects. There is a Dutch billionaire who has set up this thing called Mars One. And in the book, I actually interview this woman who has applied to be a Mars colonist and been accepted through this Mars One program. And she has a job. She has a loving family. She is married. She is living the dream middle class lifestyle. And so I said to her, you know, why would you give all this up to go to Mars? And she's sort of like, well, it's the future. It is the opportunity to be part of the future. And from interviews like that, we can see how powerful the psychology is of this idea that we can't be left out of the future.
We are speaking today with Hal Nidvietsky, who's author of the book Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. And he writes that we are inundated by technologies and billionaires who promise to improve our education system and take us to Mars and eradicate hunger and disease, all with the touch of a button or a new app. But what is behind the race to the future, and how is this obsession shaping our society, our economy, and our politics? What are your thoughts about how this is affecting? I mean, he's got some amazing examples, and we'll talk about this in a minute, about how this is affecting college campuses, how it's affecting school children, how it's affecting people who work in the warehouses. I mean, we're about to hit the holiday season, and there's a ton of people working in these factories in Southern California. In fact, the LA Times just had a piece about these Amazon workers who are really angry because drivers are paid $11 an hour, but they're suing because they say that they're getting less than California's $9 minimum wage after factoring in gas, tolls, and maintenance, because like so many workers, they're independent contractors. So what are your thoughts on our obsession with the future and how this is affecting our society? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Where are we actually heading? Who are we leaving behind by obsessing with the future? Hal is speaking tonight at City Lights Bookstore, 261 Columbus Avenue in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. So let's talk about how this is actually affecting people today.
Sure.
You write a lot about education, and you quote Cheryl Waxlask. She's a psychology professor at the University of Southern California Marshall School of Business. She says that the hype around the techno future is having drastic effects on her students. Quote, the students in business school are wildly overconfident. They are very ambitious and willing to think in broad ways. End quote. Talk about what that means and the conversation you had with her.
Sure, yeah. I mean, Cheryl's is a psychologist at this business school, and it's fascinating because she sees these kids coming in through their school, and their ideas about what they can achieve are, you know, once upon a time you had a kind of idea, well, maybe I can make a lot of money. Now you're saying maybe I can make billions of dollars and change the world, you know, which is kind of a you can't even really put it in words how how dramatically different that is from what a college student 50 years ago would think if you were to say to them, what are your ambitions? You know, this idea that we're going to change the world, and it pervades. You talked about me going to tech conferences, and a lot of what I did there was I followed people around who were trying to pitch their products, and all of them were sort of so passionate about things that were so unimportant, you know, and you'd sort of be like, so you have devoted, you know, hundreds and thousands of hours and tens and thousands of dollars of your money to create a new way to do search or a new way to go to the bar so you can arrive at the bar and your beer is already there for you.
Yeah,
you
know? And that app is actually happening.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an app in San Francisco that because I get these pitches all the time where you don't have to stand in line at the bar. You can order the drink on the way.
Yeah, and it's...
And they've got these beautiful websites for these apps and...
And they're wandering around these tech conferences muttering about $1 million valuation and I'm at level two and I don't even understand it. And I'm looking at them and I'm saying, why does this really matter to you? And they look back at me and say, this has the potential to change the world. And they're right, in a way. It does have the potential to change the world for the worse.
The other thing that Cheryl Waxlack said is working with these kids in the business school environment, a lot of them feel guilty for being conservative. I want to be responsible, but I should be doing something more. I've got this good job, and I should be doing something more.
Mm.
So they're always feeling bad because they feel like they should be doing something else.
Yeah, we get back to... my good friend in the book, Christy Foley, who wanted to go to Mars. You know, you feel like, isn't this enough that I have a life, and I'm being a productive member of society? Apparently not. And the flip side of that is the tremendous amount of anxiety that college students feel, and we all feel, that we're being left out, we're being left behind. I mean, I think the stats are something like 3 in 5 Americans are suffering from anxiety or depression. And I believe that this is directly related to this move to the future, the accelerated pace of change, the idea that if we're not on top of it, we're left behind, to be a 20-year-old at a university and be told sort of, you know, how are you going to change the future? And to know that there are people scouting you out there looking for the best ideas and ready to give you $2 million and fly you to, you know, Silicon Valley and set you up with every possible guidance you could need to achieve your goals. That's a ton of pressure, and it just spills out into our whole society.
You also write that because of all of this, colleges and universities are falling all over themselves to introduce new courses, programs, and degrees that will prepare students to get to the future first.
Mm.
More and more educational institutions are remodeling century-old programs of study to give students the future cred they need.
Rose, the degree is in disruption. You know, that's the mantra. You know, you'll see billboards saying it, ads on websites. I visited Cornell Tech, which is they're trying to build a kind of a new Stanford in off of New York City on Roosevelt Island, and literally, you know, everything that they say and do, it's all about the new. We're going to have partnerships with corporations and tech firms. It's going to be all about innovation and developing new product. And again, this spills out through even the most bucolic, quiet, liberal arts focused university is trying to figure something out that they can connect to this. So, for instance, this isn't necessarily a bucolic, quiet university, but at Utah, help me out. What's the big Brigham Young? At Brigham Young, they renamed their entire humanities program Humanities Plus. You know, and it's all about connecting to the business school and developing innovation. So, again, when I say that we're obsessed with the future and obsessed with creating a society that revolves around owning the future, these are the things that we are doing that directly relate to this obsession. And most of them are very kind of strange and have the effect of diminishing our ability to think broadly and widely about potential problems in our present day.
And we have so many. Talking about humanities, at Stanford, 45% of the faculty teaches in the humanities. Only 15% of students take the classes. At Harvard, there's been a 20% drop in students studying humanities over the last decade. And then you write, at the smaller Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania, they've cut their entire program of degrees in German, philosophy, world languages, and culture. Completely, they've gotten rid of it.
And a lot of that has to do with money, that if you want to go to your state government or your federal government for funding, they're saying, that's great. What kind of STEM programs, as in science, technology, math, and engineering, are you going to develop for us? You know, if you say, well, we want to expand our romance languages, you're coming back with a big fat zero, and that's a real, I'm not necessarily going to say it's a crisis, but it certainly is a big problem, again, when you look at the ability to think broadly and widely and also have compassion for other people and to understand the way in which some of the people we're talking about who maybe aren't able to get on board the technology bus, how they could be thinking.
I'm speaking with cultural critic Hal Nedvietsky about his new book, Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about all of these changes that are happening so rapidly around us? 866-798-8255. Because there's so much obsession with the future, things are changing quickly. What do you think about these changes? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, also talking about college, a lot of tech execs say that college is simply a big waste of time. Mick Hagan, age 28, talked to you about college. He dropped out of Princeton in 2006, moved to San Francisco to start an app, Undrip. He said, here in Silicon Valley, it's almost a badge of honor to drop out of college.
You drop out and you pursue your dream and you make millions. And you, of course, quote unquote, change the future. This is becoming another one of those like really rhetorical givens that if you can not waste your time with higher education and get right to the future changing part, you're making, you're going faster, you're getting to the future faster than other people. And also you know in our cultural climate right now, we're envisioning the future as almost an undiscovered land, and the first people who get to this land, they get to own it. They get to plant their flag and say, hey, I get the most fertile parts of this land. So again, there's this pressure and there's this ideology coming from Silicon Valley and spilling into all the higher education institutions that dropping out isn't shameful. It's good. In fact, the ideal might even be to go one better and not even bother to go to university, just go right to the pursuit of your goals. And I don't know if we have time to go with this, but there's actually a Peter Thiel, another one of these famous Silicon Valley billionaire types, actually started a scholarship in which he funded people to pursue their dreams by not going to university and going right to the future owning part.
He's the co-founder of PayPal?
Yes, that's right.
And he's a big venture capitalist.
A big venture capitalist, and he dabbles in all these different ideas. And one of them is that he's going to go find these great young talents and pay them to not go to university.
Hal Nedvietsky is a cultural critic. His newest book is Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. What are your thoughts about this? How do you think our obsession with the future is affecting our society? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
There are lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call. You can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org or join us live on the air by calling toll-free 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say, Philosophy Talk with John Perry and Ken Taylor at noon today, and then at 1 from our friends at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, it's Big Picture Science, here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about Election Day results. Today is Election Day, and I hope everyone is voting. The polls are open until 8 o'clock tonight. Tomorrow, we will have a panel and talk about how everybody voted today on affordable housing, short-term rentals, clean energy. What are you watching, and how will voters decide the issues gripping San Francisco and the greater Bay Area? Again, polls are open tonight. And if you need to find your polling place, it's very easy to find if you go online or if you call the elections department at City Hall. And then that is tomorrow. We are also putting shows together about the drought. Luckily, it rained yesterday, and so we're going to get an update on the drought in California. Today, I am speaking with cultural critic Hal Nidvietsky. His newest book is Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. He asks very important questions. Because we're so obsessed with the future, where are we really heading and who are we leaving behind? What are your thoughts on our obsession with the future and how it's shaping our society, our economy, and our politics? We'd love to hear from you. If you work in tech, we'd also love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Hal is speaking tonight at City Lights Bookstore, 261 Columbus Avenue in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And let's hear from Aaron in Oakland. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Great. So I just really had a comment on the pace at which the technology is changing and the lack of pace at which the government and society is catching up with that pace. I think we're kind of encouraging to move as quickly as possible without thinking about the repercussions, and I just really wanted to comment and maybe ask about what you think we should do about adjusting to that.
And can you be more specific, Aaron, when you're talking about how fast technology is changing, what are you talking about specifically?
So if we think about a graph over the time of the beginning of human beings or whatever, compared to the last 100 years, it's kind of skyrocketed in the last 100 years. And the pace at which we're discussing this and the government is adjusting to it is kind of not on par with how quickly technology, including computers in general, are changing those things. We kind of don't have a grip on how to cope with that. So that's really the crux of where I'm concerned, is how quickly things are changing and how slowly things are adjusting to that change.
All right. Thanks for calling. Hal?
Yeah, there's so much almost misconception around this. The first misconception, Aaron, is that we are in the midst of this explosive technological period of change. In fact, we haven't really made that many interesting things lately, I hate to put out there. You know, we have things like the iPhone, which is like television and telephone put together along with fax, and you know, it seems really exciting, but it in fact isn't. We had most of our profound innovations or inventions in the 19th century, and they mostly came from different ways to burn and use energy, and we're continuing on that way. So almost everything else is kind of surface change that makes us feel like we are changing a lot, but we're really not. We are just perfecting and accelerating the things we already had. Where the exception to that is the amount of data we can store and search, and that is where we are absolutely failing to keep up as a society with kind of social norms, what should be acceptable, what should be allowed. So we have this unbelievable capacity now to, for instance, as we famously know, thank you, Edward Snowden, capture every phone call made in America, and not only capture it, but search it. And then it becomes the question of, are we going to monitor every keystroke of our workers? Are we going to monitor every movement of certain people? What is right? What is wrong? How do we monetize this? Should we monetize it? And all these things. And we have absolutely, completely abdicated our responsibility to for-profit tech companies to determine how to use this kind of thing. And I think that's where Aaron is really right. But the overall idea that, you know, technology is just so explosive and no one can keep up with it, it's not actually true.
Well, going back to government, a number of people in your book said that we should rely less on government and institutions and rely more on this do-it-yourself movement. For many decades, the government and companies worked together to spearhead research and development in science and technology. But now these companies are trying to sideline government and say we don't need it.
Mm, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I have all these examples of kind of the social impact of that. So, for instance, there's a group that says, you know what, government is never going to solve the problem of gun control. We will solve it by inventing smart guns. And again, you know, and this same attitude can be used for everything. So you say education is failing some children in some areas of the United States. We will solve that by using technology to invent better schools. Poverty. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is floating, I don't know, drone balloons over rural India in places where millions of people are living on $2 a day and don't have access to fresh water. Or clean water, and you know, he's floating these drones that are going to provide internet for them.
He's really doing that?
Oh, yeah, it's a thing. Over Africa and India and other parts of the world where they don't have good internet access. And you say to yourself, you know, what is the ideology here? What social problems are we actually solving, and what problems are we creating? You know, what, and the whole idea that the answer to every problem is technology. A lot of these problems cannot be solved by technology, will not be solved by technology, and pointing to the future is to ignore the present.
Well, thank you for the question, Aaron. We have an email from Ari. Love today's show. It dovetails so clearly with the cultural changes happening in the Bay Area. This reminds me of something that I read recently about a recent study indicating lower levels of empathy among tech people. Have you heard of this, Hal?
I haven't heard of an official study that showed that, but certainly, you know, in the course of researching the Trees on Mars book, I come up with it again and again. George Packer wrote a great New Yorker story about this, where he was in the Bay Area, and he would go to people in tech and say, you know, I don't think that the world has actually been improved by most of the things that you've done, and the tech workers would say, I don't believe you. Like, I don't understand. I can't even understand what you are saying to me. You're speaking a different language. So I'm not at all surprised that there would be a study that shows this, because, you know, in the big picture scheme of this, the goal of all this technology is to encase us in a virtual bubble of completely privatized, perfect utopia. You know, I should have everything at my fingertips that I want, when I want it, how I want it. And that really is an anti-human idea. And I don't know if you want to get into this yet or go to another caller, but as I move to the end of the book, I start to talk about this idea that the ultimate goal is to reach the end of the future. And when we get to the end of the future, that's a tech solution to death, in which we live forever, either through some sort of singularity, through some sort of merging of the computer and the human. And there's a lot of these big companies heavily invested in that. They don't want to die. They want to live forever in a virtual utopia. And again, to me, this is not just a kind of foolhardy thing to do, but it is inherently anti-human to want to end the human race in this way and to actually pursue this.
Well, so coming back to Earth, I mean, they're also working
this
on...
This is Earth. We've never left Earth. That's what's so crazy about it.
They're working on these driverless cars, and I saw a prototype this morning for a bike that flies. And but have you, when you go to these conferences and you talk to these execs, do you ask them about growing inequality? I mean, San Francisco has some of the you know, the biggest growing inequality in the country right now. It's just widening. Do you talk about poverty? I mean, there's tent camps in Silicon Valley. People cannot make ends meet, some of them even working for these companies as contractors. Do you ask about that?
Sure. I mean, you know, as anyone will tell you, you have extremely limited access to anyone who makes decisions in the big companies of technology. And, you know, it's not like you can just go up to the vice presidents of Google and ask them these questions. But generally, again, we go back to the Mark Zuckerberg example, and they will say, well, I'm going to give everyone the internet, and that's going to solve their problems. You know, they've got cell phones for microbanking in Pakistan, so I've done my part. You know, I'm out of here. There really isn't any desire to have a big conversation about the way that technology has played a huge part in systemic growing inequality and income in our society. And, you know, I can spell out those ways if we want to get into that, and I do in the book.
You write about the Warehouse Workers United. It's one of the largest concentrations of warehouses on the planet, employing 85,000 people in Ontario, California. And these are the people who unload, unpack, reload, and repack all of the stuff that we buy. A very poor area. The median salary is about $37,000. Some people are trying to organize. A lot of people are afraid because they'll be fired and they really need the job. And then Walmart logos are no longer on the trucks down there because they don't want to be associated with it.
Yes, everything is sort of subcontracted. And so the big box stores subcontract other companies to ship these materials, and the warehouse companies subtract with hiring agencies to hire the workers. So everyone is temporary. And what's fascinating is I spent a day with these warehouse workers who are shipping all of these on-demand technologies, unloading. Everything's coming in from Asia. Big trucks come to these massive warehouses, and they're working, you know, very, very hard under extremely demanding conditions. And they themselves mostly do not benefit from this technology. You know, some of them have cell phones and use it to call home. Most of them are from Mexico or other parts of Latin and Central America. And their lives are their working lives are completely managed by technology. So they, in some cases, will have headphones that will say, you have to go to this aisle and get this box in this amount of time. And it's incredible. And if they don't meet these quotas over a certain amount of days or weeks, they'll be replaced. And if they get injured because they're hurrying and everyone is rushing around, they will be immediately replaced because they're all temp workers. They're not owed anything. And so when we think about all the positives of technology, you know, we think I can go to Amazon and order anything I want and get it the next day, which is incredible. You know, you think about the 1940s, you have to go to your Sears Roebuck catalog and order a catching mitt. It's inconceivable now. But those same technologies which provide us with these amazing advantages, if they are to be considered advantages, have this massive pool of people who have to be relentlessly micromanaged in a way that makes sort of Henry Ford and what he was doing with the invention of the assembly line, you know, makes him, like, he would be ecstatic, you know, to see this and probably very jealous. But if you're actually working these jobs, they're terrible jobs. There's no job security, and technology is used to relentlessly monitor you.
The LA Times piece I mentioned earlier about this lawsuit against Amazon by the drivers who are paid about $9 after gas, tolls, and maintenance. If the drivers arrive even 1 minute outside the required 2-hour delivery window, they could be disciplined or fired. This is according to the plaintiffs. Lawyers for the plaintiffs are seeking a class action. They say that they know exactly where we are every single minute. We're told when to take lunch, when we get there, and when we get to leave.
Mm-hmm. Everything is massively optimized. And this is to the benefit of the American consumer. It is to the substantial lack of benefit for the American worker. Those two people are the same thing, and yet not always. So there's this very complicated interplay where you will go to people and you will say, look at what the future is doing to your life. You know, it is really minimizing a lot of opportunities in your life. But it's so much easier to point to the glittery, bright, amazing things and we're going to have flying bicycles, we're going to have this or that. If you talk about going back to Elon Musk and his Tesla company, which is this all-electric vehicle, and he, you know, the fastest growing, we haven't talked much about the environment, so maybe we'll go there a little bit. The fastest selling kind of vehicle in America is the luxury SUV, which seems sort of unbelievable, but it's true. in this age of climate change and all the problems associated with it, people are really snapping up those luxury SUVs. Elon Musk and his Tesla company that's supposed to be solving these problems by putting out these all-electric vehicles just released the luxury SUV Tesla thing, and it's got DeLorean flappy wing doors. And he said, when he was introducing it, he said, "This car is so amazing, it is like a car from the future." And what does that tell us as a society? So we're looking to these people to be our leaders. They are our, you know, they say we will solve our problems through technology. We're buying SUVs. He's making an SUV that is going to make it all right for us to have SUVs. So it really tells us, from an environmental perspective, you don't have to change your consumptive patterns. You can just keep going on and on. And, you know, eventually when I manage to make a cheaper luxury all-electric SUV, because, of course, this model costs $84,000, costs a lot to own the future, you're going to, you know, we're going to get these things together, and it's going to be no problem, smooth sailing.
And in response to that, Jim says, or in a related email, "Our only hope lies in underachievers. If everyone did a little less, the planet would breathe a lot easier. Of course, we need more good in the world, but overall, less may be more."
It's absolutely true. And that's, you know, that's the sort of fundamental reality of our situation, where as a planet, we would probably be just completely better off if Silicon Valley closed down tomorrow, right? Like, there, you cannot point to me a single so-called technological innovation that has solved or is in any way close to solving a meaningful social problem in our society, including the problem of climate change.
Hal Nidvietsky is a cultural critic. His latest book is Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. He's speaking tonight at City Lights Bookstore, 261 Columbus Avenue in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. He asks, with our obsession with the future, where are we heading? How will we get there? And who are we leaving behind? You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Jeffrey in Oakland. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Good morning. So this is moving back, in a sense, to the educational and human development type issues that are posed by the just mindless use and embrace of technology. It's, one of my favorite writers, Doris Lessing, in a book of hers called Prisons That We Choose to Live In, she makes the observation that in the future, when people look back on this age, what they will say is, "Oh my God, these people had so much knowledge, but they didn't put it to use for their own benefit." And I think the two things are connected. It's like technology creates a much development in a very small part of the brain, a very small part of the human being. And so that part doesn't think about, you know, the workers who are being, you know, ground down to produce these, you know, immediate gratification marvels. It doesn't don't feel anything, say, about the environment or about other people. So I do think that it's, you know, in a way, obviously this is where things are going, and I love the book. I love the fact that, you know, time is being put into thinking about the implications of it, and I do think that educating children, educating people to value their own feelings, to value their own experience, is something that's not in the sense of what they could have but don't have now, but valuing what they actually have right now is something that is completely off the table in the way that technology is being developed and applied. And I, yeah, Yeah, I think it's a very dangerous situation.
Well, thank you for calling, Jeffrey. And we have to spend more time on this. I was just reading in, I think it was yesterday's paper, about the fact that so many children are now spending so much time on iPads.
Mm.
And, you know, this is happening, and sociologists are just starting to study this.
The whole tablet thing is amazing. You know, first we had the idea we were going to give every single kid a laptop, either in some, you know, poor, underdeveloped country, we'd solve all their problems by giving them a laptop, and then, or here. And then all of a sudden we started giving everyone iPads and tablets, every student, kindergarten kids, first graders, high school students. And when I was researching this aspect of you know, how our ideology of future is changing education, I said, well, there must be studies that show this works, that students get better grades. But there aren't. There. In fact, it's the opposite. The studies show that if you give a bunch of kids tablets, they will break through the locks to keep them from going online, go online, and get worse grades in the long term. So why are we doing it? But we still do it. And it is this, as Jeffrey said, small part of the brain. It's, you know, what's the solution for this? It's not going to be better teachers, investing more money in social programs, making sure no one goes to school hungry. The solution is to throw an iPad onto every desk.
Andrew writes, I teach at a Bay Area university and see students who cannot write, talk, or think. At times, I'm heartbroken watching them obsess in their selfies as if they don't know they exist unless they see themselves through the day. They go on dates, they sit side by side on their phones, and we call this progress. He writes, it seems like the end of community built on the propaganda that it builds community. And then we have a caller, Michelle, who couldn't stand the line, who says, I'm a teacher. Most of my students are black and brown youth, and the race to the future talk is not even on their radar.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the left behind, right? We've seen a lot of studies in Silicon Valley showing that the people in Silicon Valley are white men, you know, and then to sort of say, well, why aren't they solving the problems of other minorities and people in other social income brackets? Well, you know what? That's not their experience. They don't see those people every day. They see the people who are like, oh, man, I have to go to the bar and wait for a drink. How can I solve this pressing problem? you know, I mean, I think it is one of those things where we can go sort of too far in a way. And I'm not anti-technology, and I think it's important to say that. I'm anti-ideology. You know, I'm anti the ideology that technology is the saving grace of society. I mean, if we didn't use technology, most of the planet would be starving at this point. You know, the so-called Green Revolution that solved amazing problems, and we continue to use technology to solve our problems. But when technology creates a problem, and then we say the solution to it must be more technology, we just keep ratcheting up the crisis level. So the problem is, in relation to the comment you read by Elizabeth, we don't have community like we used to, and we yearn for it, and we desperately want that community. What's the answer to that? Technology is one of the reasons we don't have community, specifically television, which sucked up so much of our time and energy. So the answer to that now is going to be Facebook and Twitter and social media and texting. You know, you can't solve this problem with more technology. You have to go and think differently about these problems. And this is where this isn't the direction that we are going.
Jason writes, passionate about the unimportant really describes the point that we have reached. So much tech investment is focused on the trivial, but it has real world effects that are dramatic, especially in distorting our social economy. In San Francisco, for example, he writes, tech disruption is actually not a progressive idea because it pushes more power to fewer people.
Mm, the idea of disruption is such a bizarre idea. Again, you get to the history of humanity and what we have always wanted and how our minds have developed. We are, as a people, have developed as so resistant to change that, you know, that we would do, we'll kill all the animals, then we'll kill all the little animals, you know, we'll kill everything in sight before we even begin to suggest that we should change our society. And so, for better or worse, We are not change agents. We do not like disruption. You know, the only time that we kind of really embrace technology is at a crisis moment in a society where we've overused resources. And that's where we are now. And so our widespread embrace of this ideology of future is really the embrace of an unsustainable present that we desperately don't want to change. And, you know, that was in a way the big takeaway from the book.
So what was the takeaway for you? Because you spoke to Paul Kingsnorth, who's with the Dark Mountain Project, and I'm fascinated by this. I did so much reading about it this weekend. He was very honest with you, and he said, we are not going to stop the global economy. Those of us fighting to build a different kind of world and values are losing. We have to live with that and deal with that and ask ourselves, what then? Many people, ex-activists, say, I'm very glad you said this because this is how I've been feeling.
Yeah, I mean, this was a big revelation for me as I got to the end of this book, and I said, how can we put this in a context of humanity and what this means for us as the human race? And, you know, with technology being so pervasive and so obviously a kind of last gap Band-Aid attempt to maintain an unsustainable present, we are now in a world where we have to start admitting certain things. And the main thing we have to admit is, as Paul Kingsnorth said, the global economy is unstoppable. The damage to climate change, the damage to our climate and ongoing climate change, unstoppable. There's two things that come out for me. The first is we need to learn to talk about this. We need to be able to say, you know what, we all want it to change, but we can't. Okay, we won't get to the second thing, but that's okay. Oh, we have a little time. And the second thing is that doesn't mean we should give up. You know, there's still worth in finding new ways to communicate.
Hal Nidvietsky is a cultural critic. His book is Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future, and he's speaking tonight at City Lights Bookstore, 261 Columbus Avenue in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. Don't give up. Hal, thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for your emails and phone calls. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll recap the outcome of Election Day with 11 propositions on the San Francisco ballot and a heated district race that could tip the balance of power in City Hall. How will the outcomes affect the city's future? Affordable housing, short-term rentals, and clean energy are among the issues at stake. So what are you watching, and how will voters decide the issues gripping San Francisco and the Greater Bay Area? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.